南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Hello, hello, everyone. To all those new subscribers, welcome. To those of you who've been with me for any length of time, welcome back. I hope that, of course, as always, this video finds you in good health and in secure circumstances. Namo myo renge kyo. Deeply appreciate all of you. Don't forget, take a moment right now. Like, subscribe. I'm more concerned about subscription. Because it helps this video rise up in the queue, as it were, for searches on YouTube, so we can get this information out to the most people that we can. And we're approaching, I don't want to jinx it, but we're getting close to 1,000 subscribers. And I'd really like to push that over the hump so that our Sangha can continue to grow by leaps and bounds. Okay, now that that business is out of the way, and don't forget, you know, this is a big resource ever. It's not just this channel. There's videos on this channel about how to use these resources. It names all the websites and stores and all of that that are connected to this school of Buddhism. But also pictures on how to use the search in this channel, so you can search within the channel, not within all of YouTube. As we're getting close to 800 videos now, so it's not the kind of thing you want to go video by video and go, well, what interests me today? You can look for specific keywords, you know, from karma to daimoku to 3,000 realms through original enlightenment, whatever, and you'll get a result set. Maybe several and maybe a few, but it's a lot easier to sort through those than it is. And there are playlists. I mean, if your only interest is, you know, I haven't really fully read the Lotus Sutra, I go chapter by chapter, read the whole threefold lotus, the introductory, you know, innumerable meanings, all the 28 chapters, as well as the universal Bodhisattva chapter, the closing. And there's a, I don't know, maybe 150 videos just on that. And there's a playlist called Lotus Lectures that's just about the Threefold Lotus Sutra. So the playlists are handy too, don't just the search, right? So I just want you to use the tool, get the most out of it that you can. Maybe the only thing that you're curious about is the Vimalakirti Sutra. Well, there are a set of videos, a playlist on that. I talk about it through many other videos, but there are videos that I did several years ago that are solely on the Vimalakirti. So that kind of thing. Use the resource. This is your practice. Make it work for you. Yeah? All I can do is provide as much information and insight as I've gained over 40 years of practice and share it with you and make this resource available for your consideration, right? For your practice. It's your Buddhahood, so it's all on you. Okay. We are in the process of reading one of the, maybe the most important writing of Nichiren, the opening of the eyes. It's called different things depending on who's translating it, but that's basically it. I would translate it as opening the Buddha eye. But, you know, we open the Buddha eye through our own mind's eye, not this eye, right? Our perceptive eye. And so we're in the midst right now. We're going to close today the chapter on, what was this chapter called? Page Turning Karma. Oh my goodness. This was a long chapter. Oh my, did I miss it? There it is. Obtaining Buddhahood by the Two Vehicles. Ah, well. Yeah, one of the big moments of the Lotus Sutra is finally, because no other sutra, no provisional sutra, no earlier sutra provided for the Sravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, almost a prohibition, you might say, against the earlier teachings and the sects, like 20 some odd sects that took off running with those first early teachings, oral teachings of Shakyamunis, and thought they had the whole thing. So they didn't need to learn anymore. They didn't need to follow along anymore. So they're usually called Hinayana, which is a bit of a derisive term. Different people have trouble with that. But it's a classification that the early teachings were the early stepping stones that had conceptually the aim of, this was the aim before Siddhartha attained enlightenment, was a process and a cultivation of mind that would liberate all people, no matter what status, finance, condition, whatever, all sentient beings should be able to live a life without the constant stress and anxiety of getting sick, and anxieties about death, and the trauma of birth, and all these kinds of personal pain that he witnessed in India. He thought, well, yeah, we're all going to experience, you know, pain and trauma in life, but there's this living with this stress, constantly worrying about it, constantly worrying about, feeding ourselves and possessions and loss of possessions. And it's just so stressful to live life. Life shouldn't be this stressful. Now, it comes from a guy who's a prince who has everything done for him. So yeah, to him, it's foreign land. Whatever his motives, you might say, you know, there's the criticality of privilege. I mean, you wouldn't be wrong to say any of those things. And I know a lot of Buddhists out there go, what are you talking about? Seriously, this is the story of how Buddhism began. Siddhartha Gautama, his father, a king, a leader, maybe not by definition a king, but a huge landowner, who had to protect that land. You know, the same kind of situation that later, centuries later, millennia later, we would call in Japan, shogunate, samurai. It wasn't shogunate, samurai in India, but the same situation. It was a clan of warriors that maintained a huge expanse of property, and the people living on that property were subservient to them, serfs. I mean, today, India has a massive caste system, right? That cannot be you can't go, you know, we think about the caste system in the West as, oh yeah, you know, the poverty class, the middle class, but there's always the chance in the West, it may not happen very often, but you can work yourself out of one class into another. That is the great hope or dream of America, right? Not that it's accomplishable, because the upper classes have made damn sure that they've put enough obstacles in the way that you better know your place. So in a way, it's not that different from the caste system. But in the caste system, genetically, bloodline, you know, you're not moving from one to another. Anyway, my point is, Buddhism was always about, even before it became Buddhism, the idea that whatever our tendencies and conditions in life, we should mentally be able to live well without stressing about whatever our conditions are. Because truly, if you think about it, though the consequences may vary, don't beat me up for this. And I tried to point this out to a few people in my life. You know, when I've never been of the upper classes. I've always been in the low middle class to poverty. And I've been in poverty for a long time now. And so when I speak to others that are in poverty or that cusp between poverty and middle class, that wavering ground where you're always worried about money, but you have enough to go on. It's not quite poverty, is it? But it's not quite middle class either. Anyway, you know, when you lose, say you're very fond of, or, you know, I don't care if it's your blender in the kitchen or a guitar that somebody sat on and destroyed, or you know, maybe it's your car having problems, or your car gets stolen. And that's a major, major problem. Yes, it's a major, major problem. And then I say to that person, but, you know, when multi-billionaire over there, his son, who's been raised in millionaireing, loses his car, he's just as upset as you are. Oh man, people don't want to hear that. Because pain is pain. Upset is upset. Now, he may heal his upsetness, the rich one, very simply. Dad, I need a new car. Okay, I'll have one delivered to you this afternoon. Yeah, his pain and suffering is easily minimized. Gotcha. But that first moment when he walks out into the parking lot at the restaurant, he took some fancy lunch with a girl or whatever, another person, by himself, who cares? When he first walks out into the parking lot and sees that his car's been stolen, that shock, that pain, the anger that might ensue, it's the same as yours and mine. I know we don't want to believe that. Simply by virtue of the fact that it's going to be really hard for us to recover from it. But that initial pain, it's still the same trauma. He just can, or she can, ameliorate it very easily. But it also points out the tremendous attachment to thingness. And so what am I trying to say? I'm saying that Siddhartha, viewing all these different, and admittedly, when he left the kingdom grounds, the protected grounds of his life, and went out, there was pretty much only one class that he was seeing, yeah? But there were merchants who were also suffering. There were different castes that were suffering. And what Siddhartha was addressing was that everyone universally had something to worry about. Whether it was life-threatening or not, yeah, that's a distinction. Absolutely. I'm not trying to deny that, so please understand me. What I'm saying is fundamentally, though, everyone was living with certain amounts of stress, and arguably, whether they were stressed about market forces or stressed about finding clothing, stress is stress. And stress is very destructive. Some can recover more easily than others, but stress is stress. And so how do we live life, no matter what our circumstance, without experiencing all of that stress and anxiety? How do we do it? There's got to be a way. And that's what started him on a path for 6 or 7 years of studying amongst every known, and he had access, Brahmin, the Brahmin class, those teacher class people, the elites, who were responsible for guiding people's spirituality How do I live life to the best of my ability, the best possible? Just give it to me. I want to find the best one. You say to pray to elephants, I'll pray to elephants. Just let me find a truth here. There's got to be a truth that just is non-sectarian, is non-divisioned, is just a true truth. Because that's the only thing that's universal. If praying to elephants is what gets you there, it's not universal. There's a lot of people who aren't going to have that kind of feeling about elephants. Right? He studied all the top teachers, starved himself to the point of almost dying because of the practice of asceticism, right? You want to know the nature of food and your attachment to food? Stop eating for a while. See what your mind goes through. See what your body goes through. See how you experience your relationship with food, feeding, nourishment, existing. It can get pretty deep. You can learn a lot of things about yourself. Right? Don't speak for, you know, it's folklore at this point. All of these prohibitions. And after 6 or 7 years of it, having survived it, he learned a lot about himself, but it didn't tell him how to avoid experiencing stress and anxiety. It was always there. Will I stop eating? Will I die? Do I need to eat? If I eat, have I failed? Right? How do we get away from that constant reminder that there is something both required of us and at the same time kind of ephemeral? It's a matter of choice, choosing. How deep does that go? How deep do my choices go until I reach a place where my choices are just laid out in front of me and they're not really choices anymore. They're just the function, like breathing. I don't ask myself, well, do I need to breathe again? I think I do. I better do that. We don't do that with our heartbeat, with our breathing, right? That's where all that early stuff comes about, counting your breaths and watching your breathing. It's a way of understanding the process of our body and being mindful of it. But that's not the reason for it. The reason for it is to find something that transcends that very process, that's there all along. How does the mind, the brain, the body program itself to do these things? What are the formations of that act? That's truly profound. So it's not so much about the breathing, is it? It's about every single thing that goes through our mind. How does it form? What is the source? Is the source necessary, or is it simply the process that we must understand and therefore apply to all of life? Now we're getting closer. So Shakyamuni ends up sitting down, dissatisfied with all of these teachers. He said, I'm going to figure this out. And he sits down and he makes a vow. I'm not rising from this seat and this internal meditation, this traveling through my mind and formations until I solve it. I've got to unlock this. Otherwise, why go on living? So, dedication, yeah? That's why you see throughout Buddhism, you've got to be able to commit yourself to the level of this body isn't important. This body is an obstacle for me to get this, because I'm always in service of this damn body. I've got to transcend that too. So I got to be so focused on this transcendent understanding of life that the body will just follow. But I can't be concerned about the body if I'm going to focus on what this is, what the ultimate truth is. That kind of commitment. And it's throughout the sutras, right? You know, this whole thing about burning his arm or ripping his flesh off to write stuff down, these personages. Shakyamuni keeps talking about this. It's not that you have to eviscerate yourself. Don't start burning yourself or ripping flesh off yourself. That's not what it's about. It's the level of commitment that it's about. Make up your mind. Because there it is. Buddhism. And if something is distracting you from that focus, then that is going to keep you from your enlightenment. Aha! The people of the two vehicles are so enamored with all of the songs, the verbal teachings of Buddhism in the early years. They're so insightful. They're so rhythmic. I know every word. I can write them down. I can recite them. And they're all written in the first person. So it's all about me attaining. And they're so glued to that me attaining that they've missed the point. Because the me is what's unimportant here. The body is what's unimportant here. It's all about the mind. And they missed that in the early teachings. If they'd have stuck with it into Mahayana teachings, more developed teachings throughout the remainder of Shakyamuni's life, they would have understood that. But they stopped at one point and thought, this is it. I don't need to learn anymore. I got it. And so they cut themselves off from their enlightenment. Do you see now why it's called Hinayana versus Mahayana? During the lifetime of Shakyamuni Buddha, there might have been some who cast aside the sutras preached during the first 40 years or so of his teachings and sided, though with difficulty, with the Lotus Sutra. It was hard because the Lotus Sutra says, you can be completely unattached. It's scary. Ooh, what do you mean? Just be mind? Well, that's all you are anyway. Hard to really envision that, yeah? After his death, however, it must have been very difficult to open, read, and put conviction in this sutra. Once Shakyamuni was gone, he wasn't there teaching and helping people understand. People were left to their own devices to attain enlightenment, to continue his teachings. It was easy to get doubt, right? For one, while those sutras preached before the Lotus Sutra consists of many words, right? There's volumes and volumes of those teachings. Not only those teachings that were rhythmic and song-like, but with little commentaries, different sermons for, you know, you teach the same thing for a dozen years. You've got to add something that's particular to the people you're talking to, because that's what Shakyamuni did. He traveled. He didn't just sit in one spot. And people in different parts of India had different cultural cues and realities. So we read a lot of stories in the sutras, and we read a lot of rhythmic sections in the sutras. But you might think of that as the rhythmic sections being the actual sermon transmitted and learned by, memorized by students. But they're also concatenations of the stories, and the stories that are in those sutras may come from different times during that 12 years of teaching for a particular sermon that address a particular crowd and their cultural understandings. You see? Anyway, all of those pre-Lotus Sutras, they consist of many, many volumes, many words. And the Lotus Sutra itself consists of just a few words by comparison, yeah? While the former consists of many sutras, the latter consists of just one. While the former are preachings of many years, the latter is just of 8 years. And there's various numbers of years. You can research that on Google if you like. About how many years certain sutras, that BDK has a list of all the sutras and the time periods and how many years they were taught for, or in some case weeks, like the Avatamsaka. You know? To many, the Buddha is a great liar who cannot be trusted. Because as we discussed earlier in earlier videos, certain statements were made that are later contradicted, if none other by the Lotus Sutra itself, the culmination of the teachings. So this is why I say, until you go through the entire scholarship of Buddhism and get to the Lotus, you're never really going to understand Buddhism. Lotus Sutra is very, very key and important in that respect, but it doesn't deny the importance of all the previous sutras. It just puts them in proper order and place. They're developments, yeah? If they believe in them at all, they might believe in those sutras preached before the Lotus Sutra. They might have insights and aha moments from those earlier teachings, and therefore they have a hard time moving on from them because they've learned so much in them. That's what we do, right? Never in the Lotus Sutra itself, for many reasons, right? Oh, that's a lofty teachings for the elites. I'll never understand it. And so they read it with that in mind and they don't get the message at all. Or they read it, they're exposed to it, but they don't get insight right away, so they don't trust that it has anything for them. List the reasons. You can go on and on, right? Also, it appears today that everyone seems to put their conviction in the Lotus Sutra, but their conviction is only superficial. Yeah, we know that's the best teaching, but I'm really comfortable over here. This is what's popular over here. I want to be part of a bigger group, and that Lotus Sutra, all those people are always, you know, they're rebels, and I don't want to be associated with them. All kinds of reasons, right? Which means their conviction isn't deeply held, like it says here. Not with their heart. They willingly put conviction in those who do not see any difference between the Lotus Sutra on the one hand and the Great Sun Buddha Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra, or the Pure Land Sutra on the other hand, without believing those who see differences between them. Even if they believe the latter, they do so reluctantly. Right, because they're all comfortable with their little group or their little sect and their little bridge games and their what do you call those things? Those parties where everybody brings their own dish, you know, that kind of thing. We're social creatures, so if belonging to a certain group means you got to take a certain amount of abuse from a bunch of others, you're less likely to do it just based on that ego. Nobody believes in me, Nichiren says, who is saying that it was Great Master Dengyo alone who read the Lotus Sutra correctly some 700 years after the introduction of Buddhism to Japan. But do you see why he says that? Because there's been 700 years of history in Japan of following these other groups and well-established practices, right? Upheld by the elite. So why do something new? Why be a rebel? Why point out the emperor's naked? Just, you know, let him have his fantasy. We'll all get along. We'll all be happy. Even though we're all happy under the umbrella of a lie. The emperor's naked. Oh, don't say that. Don't say that. That's the exact situation. It is stated, however, in the Lotus Sutra, quote, it is not difficult to grab the Mount Everest and throw it across the planet. Well, obviously, it's a relative statement, right? It's another one of those skillful means of teachings. In other words, it's easier to pick up Mount Everest with one hand and toss it across the planet than it is to throw it over to any of those numerous Buddha lands. But it's difficult to teach the Lotus Sutra in this decadent world after the extinction of Shakyamuni. It says death of the Buddha, but that's totally wrong, of course. It's a reference to Shakyamuni. My stubborn insistence is matched by the sutra. That's interesting. So he's saying the Lotus Sutra is very insistent. It is the truth. It is how we awaken our Buddha mind. And I, Nichiren, am just as insistent. Interesting. It is said in the Nirvana Sutra, quote, or an amplification of the Lotus Sutra. You notice what he's calling the Nirvana Sutra now. This is a sutra taught after the Lotus Sutra. And we know from the Lotus Sutra that the Lotus Sutra is the most true and direct teaching of all the teachings before, during, or after the teaching of the Lotus Sutra. The Nirvana comes after, therefore it's subservient to the Lotus. And he says here, an amplification of the Lotus Sutra. Quote, the slanderers of the true Dharma in the latter age of decay are countless in number, just as the soil of all the entirety in the universe is immeasurable. Those who keep the true Dharma are few in number, just like a bit of soil on a fingernail. Nichiren says, what should we think of this? Please think hard whether or not the people of Japan represent a bit of soil on the fingernail, those people of perspicacity. And Nichiren represents the soil in the entire universe. Reason wins under the rule of a wise king, like a wise mind, a ruler. And foolishness gets the upper hand under the rule of an unwise sovereign. And who is your king, sovereign, parent, teacher? Buddha, your Buddha mind. That's Buddha. What are you ruled by? Your cravings? Or your mind's reason and rationale? That's what Nichiren is saying right here. Reason wins under the rule of a wise king, and foolishness gets the upper hand under the rule of an unwise sovereign. So remember, it is in the world It is in the world of wonderful people that the true teachings of the Lotus Sutra are revealed. Regarding this teaching concerning whether it is possible for men of the two vehicles to become Buddhas, those sutras preached before the Lotus Sutra appear more powerful than the theoretical section, the Shakyamuni section of the Lotus, because they're so voluminous and they have so much history. If the former, which insists that it is impossible, win over the latter, which maintains that it is possible that such men of the two vehicles as Shariputra, Kashyapa, will never be able to attain Buddhahood, how regrettable it would be for them. And that's how he closes the chapter. So what he's saying is, with all this history and all this scholarship pointing to the men of the two vehicles, the Shravakas, Pratyekabuddhas, learning, realization, that they could never attain Buddhahood. Ichantika, they don't even have the seeds of Buddhahood in them. And then suddenly in the Lotus, they're told, if you awaken your Buddha mind and pursue a Bodhisattva path, not learning and realization, not enamored with your own ability to learn, recite, remember, but understand that it isn't about you. It's about life, bodhisattva, all of your environment, because that's you. If you open your mind to understanding that your life is only identified as yours by virtue of being part of all of life, now your mind can truly reach Buddhahood. If you can do that, as this Lotus Sutra, this Myoho Renge Kyo prescribes, then you too can attain Buddhahood. That realization only comes out in the Lotus Sutra, the Myoho Renge Kyo. And so Nichiren is saying, well, if you're going to deny the Lotus Sutra its proper place as the culmination of the teachings, then you don't understand what all the teachings have been about. How lamentable is that? Because you yourself are cutting yourself off, just like the men of Shravaka and Pratyekabuddha. You're being in that camp. You're wasting away misery in your life when you could be experiencing all of this stuff in life as an amazing event. The next chapter, Attaining Enlightenment in the Eternal Past. What is eternal? What is past? You know, and I'll close with this because, well, we got plenty of time. This idea of eternity, and the translators love to use it. Past, present, and future. We're modern people. You probably have heard of Albert Einstein. You remember what he said about time? And people will misunderstand this too. That all time, past, quote unquote, present, and future, quote unquote, are all happening all at once, all the time. That Albert Einstein said this. And it's kind of a mind-bending thing to visualize, to conceive, that all time is happening at this very moment. All of it. Not that it's predetermined, that the thing we call time is happening moment to moment, and that it includes all time. When we say, now I want you to think about this from the standpoint of your Buddhist practice and the amazing enlightenment of this man Shakyamuni. We translate time without beginning, time without end. What does that mean? Furthermore, Einstein, I'll add another piece to the puzzle, said that the only difference between past, present, and future is a matter of where you specifically, the observer, is in it. Or more accurately, from the standpoint of the observer. Who's the observer? It's so perfect. It's so Buddhist. You are an observer of your experience of the universe, of all time space. And I am the observer of my experience of the universe from my vantage point, from my place in time, space. What does all that mean? It means simply that the karma, the tendencies and conditions that accumulated to form this apparatus that I call me, is not exactly precisely the same as the energies and tendencies and conditions that came together to form your apparatus of who you call yourself, self. If they were the same, we would be in one place. There would only be one of, oh, what did I just hit on? When we open our access, our Gohanzon to Buddha, we are all in one place. That's where the solution is. There's no competition there. There's no choice there. There is only raw, perfect understanding and experience. Therefore, all of the stresses, the anxieties, the possessing, the losing, all of that schmear, it just has no place there. It has no raison d'être. It doesn't need to be in our minds. We experience all the same things. It's the same. It's life. It's the way the universe pumps away constantly, manifesting potential. And on that level, all of the stress and anxiety of possessing, owning the earthly things, right? The identified things, mine, yours, me, all of that, it's just, it loses its power. Your name and your apparatus and the place you live, it doesn't evaporate, it doesn't go away. It's simply that your experience of it is liberated from the stresses of hanging on. We just join the flow of manifestations, energy moving through time-space. Is there a distance to that? No. The distance is whatever your mind conceives. It's timeless. And therefore, it all collapses into one moment. This moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. Make sense? Well, I hope you got something out of that chapter. The next one, again, Attaining Enlightenment in the Eternal Past. We're going to be playing with time again here. But I hope that my discussion helps you get a glimpse of what Buddha-ness is and how all you need do is awaken it. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. Thank you for your practice. The more you practice, the more people in your environment that you influence, the more we do that together through this thing called YouTube, the internet, right? Like, subscribe, share. The more this teaching reaches more minds to achieve these kinds of insights, the more secure our existence will be. Gosh, I can't wait. I don't know if I'll live long enough to see the day when nations embrace each other's existence. when things like Russia, Ukraine just don't happen. The great American empire stops trying to own the entire planet. Everybody settles into their own zone, sharing what they can share, living off their abundance, because this planet is abundant. It is human beings with their greed and their manipulations of anger, and quite frankly, their stupidity, that keep this false, dirty engine of suffering going. And it's up to you and I, and people who can come to this realization of the magnificent universal energy of life, liberating us from the avarice, the greed, the possessing, the taking. It's just so, it's so much energy spent against life. It really is. The value of life is life, the mind. Let's promote that together, okay? Celebrate your life. Patrons, you guys are amazing. Thank you. If any of you can join in, go to patreon.com/TLK and offer any little, it doesn't have to be a continuous month to month. It can be just one offering. Or you can do it at paypal.me/SifuSylvain. It's in the video. You'll see it. Anything you can, and I don't want you to go out of your way and create a hardship for yourself. Of course not. Just watching these videos, liking, subscribing, very, very beneficial for our mission. But if you can afford it all, to keep this equipment running, to keep the subscriptions to the internet going, so that I can expand the resources and keep this teaching growing. Amazing, right? Namo Myōrengekyō. Thanks again. Thanks for being here. I'll see you in the next one. I'll shut up now. And I'll see you again. Bye for now.